From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. It's hard to believe that it's only been just over a week since the Trump-Kim summit in Singapore, and we're still trying to parse out what exactly the Singapore statement means for the Korean Peninsula going forward. But many people have very strong opinions on this, and particularly on North Korea's intentions towards denuclearization. So with that in mind, we have a great expert guest here for the podcast this week. Dr. Marco Milani is a lecturer in the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California. And he recently wrote a paper here at KEI about North Korea's nuclear identity and how the identity feeds into why they need nuclear weapons or why they feel they need nuclear weapons and what that might mean for what we can do on denuclearization. As always, please do like and subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you're getting your podcast fix. And please enjoy the conversation. So, Dr. Milani, thank you so much for coming and both sharing your research with us at the program today, but then also talking to me here for the podcast.
Thank you.
So you started off your talk with the definition of security and how that definition has shifted over time. Different parts have been brought in. So I'm wondering if you can start off with that. How did you define security, or how did you include some of these other aspects of security versus only the hard missiles and nukes as far as North Korea is concerned?
Security, we can define security ultimately about like survival. The most important thing is survival. So once we focus on this point, then we can start to find all the different threats for the survival of a specific referent object. In this case, in international relations, usually the referent object is the state. So traditionally, of course, the main threat is the military threat, the threat from external attacks from the outside. But there are also other threats that must be taken into consideration. And that's here that non-traditional security emerged as an important concern. So starting from the early 90s, we see this broadening and widening of the concept of security. So other issues became security issues for the state, not only the military part, but the economic part, for example, or human security, for example. Human rights abuses for some states became a matter of security. Environmental security became crucial, energy security. All these different issues became part of how to protect the most important referent object for international relations, that is the state.
So to apply that to North Korea, how did you start to envision, or what made you decide to look at this through these non-traditional security issues with North Korea?
Well, the reason, I think, the main reason is that for me, it's very important to understand why a relatively poor country decided to commit such an amount of resources to achieve the goal of developing nuclear weapons, because the regime committed a lot of resources for that. So why they did that? Is it only for military reasons, or there's something more? That's why I started to use this framework of non-traditional security applied to North Korea. At the same time, it's a little bit tricky doing that with North Korea, because non-traditional security is usually understood in terms of, for what concerns the liberal world order. If we think, for example, of environmental security or human security, these issues are crucial for specific states, there are Western countries, for example, and all the countries that are part of this liberal world order. And of course, North Korea is not part of that. So it's not like, intuitively, it's not something that you do apply this to North Korea. But if we use this idea of horizontal security, not vertical, so the fact that the referent object remains the state, but that the state is threatened by multiple issues, then we can apply non-traditional security to North Korea too.
You also argue that nuclear weapons became somehow integrated and essential for both the identity of the Kim regime, but also ideologically integrated into the regime. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that evolved over time?
Well, Formally, nuclear weapons became part of the ideology of the regime with the launch of Byongjin Line, but if we think of Byongjin, we can also see it as a sort of evolution or next step of the military first policy of Kim Jong-il. The point of military first was to use the military system of North Korea not only for military purposes, but for non-traditional, non-military purposes, like providing basic goods for the population, for example. So during the Songun period, the military was not only the actor who was in charge of defending the country, but was the depository of the entire power structure of the regime. The military became the most important power structure within the regime, not only for military issues, but also for political and economic issues. And there was not a clear specific emphasis on the nuclear program at the time. With the Byongjin Line, we see a shift from this focus on the military system, again, toward the party system on one side. But on the other side, the importance of the military remained in the first pillar of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons, well, the development of nuclear weapons is crucial to defend the country. So what was done by the military before now can be done by nuclear weapons. Because according to the Byongjin Line, nuclear weapons are also the most cost-effective strategy for that. And that's something that Kim Jong-un clearly stated in more than once, that if we develop nuclear weapons, we can use more resources for economic development. That's one of the key points of the Byongjin Line.
This is actually following on to the last point you made, talking about how Kim Jong-un messages this, how he messages the nuclear program, both to his people and to the international community. I'm obviously the PR person here at KEI, so that's something that really interests me. Some may argue that their statements can't really be trusted or you have to take it with a grain of salt. But how have you seen the messaging of the nuclear weapons and how does that fit into your argument that they are essential to the identity of the regime?
Well, I think that it's very important to take every single word from the regime, cum grano salis, and not take every single word, well, we think they are saying. But at the same time, we have to listen to what they are saying, because most of the time, people try to take only the part that is most interesting from these speeches and things like that. Usually, the example is statements like North Korea will attack the United States with nuclear weapons, comma, if the United States attack first. And this second line is usually dropped. So I think that it's very important to focus on what they are saying, because if we listen to what they are saying, we can understand a lot about the regime, since we don't have access to many information inside. And I think that the way Kim Jong-un started to use these messages about the nuclear program gives us clear indications of what the goals of the regime are right from the beginning. That's why I think that it's very important the fact that in November and then again with the New Year speech, they said we achieved the status of nuclear power, even if maybe that's not completely true, 100% true. But that's the message that they want to send to the international community and to their own people. So I think that in this perspective is very important to listen to what they're saying.
Yeah, and you give the example as well of talking about the nuclear weapons and the nuclear program as defensive, and they've repeated that multiple times. How does that play into what you're arguing about the goals of the regime, the fact that they have very clearly stated that they want it for defensive purposes only?
Yeah, I think my perspective on that is that the nuclear program is totally defensive. There are other interpretations of that as a nuclear program, as a weapon to can lead to military unification with South Korea, for example. But from my perspective, it's totally defensive. And this defensive perspective does not only apply to the military aspect, but the nuclear program is there also to defend the other aspect of security. So defend, in a way, the economy, and on the other side, defending the legitimacy of the regime. So I think that this defensive character of the nuclear program is perfectly fits in the non-traditional model of security for North Korea.
So the fact that Kim Jong-un had conducted these many missile and nuclear tests over the last few years and declared the program complete, there are obviously two very different audiences for that. You mentioned this as well, that there's the international audience and the domestic audience. So how do you see that messaging being different, or is there anything that's similar between those two intended audiences?
I think that the message, I mean, the words are the same, but the message to the different audience is different. Because for the internal audience, the message is we achieved the first pillar of the Byongjin line. Now we are a nuclear weapon state. We fulfilled our commitment in the preamble of the Constitution and everything. But at the same time, for the international community, the message is we are not going to perform any other missile nuclear test. We are ready for negotiations and this kind of approach more toward a more diplomatic approach. So I think that this is a very clever use of how to differentiate the same statement to different audiences. Because I think that is obvious that, for example, when Kim Jong-un declared that North Korea doesn't need any more tests, there are different meanings for that. And one of the meanings is that we don't need the tests because we are already a nuclear power. But at the same time, the regime is saying we're going to stop the tests. So we are ready to talk with the international community. I think that was a very, very smart move from the regime.
So to follow up on that, I think a lot of people, even in the longtime Korea watcher community, were quite surprised at the almost 180 attitude change between, you know, November 2017 and February 2018, I mean, just a few month period. So how do you interpret that? And you've talked a little bit about this, but how do you interpret that sudden outreach on the part of Kim Jong-un and his sudden willingness to talk to the international community? How do you interpret that?
Well, I think that this is part of a broader strategy of North Korea that probably not many of us studying North Korea has envisioned in the past, but it's part of a big strategy because they worked on the nuclear program, and after that they started working on international recognition for North Korea and economic development for the country. And I think that a part of this shift is not because of a shift of Kim Jong-un personality or leadership, but is a shift more on how the Western world, especially Western media, see the leader. Because, for example, there's this idea of Kim Jong-un as a nuclear madman, and now he's like a leader, a smart politician, all this kind of thing, but he's the same person. So I don't think that he was a nuclear madman before. I think that he was a very smart politician right from the beginning, and he just played his strategy, and he is achieving a lot of important goals for the regime. I don't know if in the best interest of its country, but for the regime, he's achieving a lot.
So if you were able to sit down with President Trump as this negotiation starts to get underway, what would you say to him, or how would you encourage him to use some of your ideas about the importance of these non-traditional security elements, or the importance of the identity part of this nuclear program? What would you say to President Trump to help him approach this negotiation?
Well, the first thing will be flexible. Because I think that at this point, flexibility will be the key word for negotiations. Because if the United States continue with the logic of the six-party talks of this tit-for-tat or quid pro quo or concessions logic, I don't think it's going to go well. So my point is that try to build trust between the parties and be flexible on what you want from North Korea, because you cannot get anything in one summit, especially if it's organized in like 2 months. So for me, the best thing will be to start a process of high-level meeting and negotiations that can build trust, not only between the two leaders, but can build trust between the people at the State Department and the North Korean officials of the regime, and then can lead to a more normal state-to-state relation between the United States and North Korea. I think that can be a very important path forward, and differs from what happened in the past.
How would your answer change if I asked you what your advice for President Moon would be, or would it change?
For President Moon? Mm-hmm. I think he's doing a great job. I was a little bit skeptical at the beginning with this dual track of denuclearization and cooperation because I didn't think it could work. But now I think that he's doing a really, really good job. So I will tell him just keep doing what you're doing because it's working.
So some might argue, maybe some who are a little bit more hardline towards North Korea might argue that, you know, okay, sure, I'll agree with you that this has somehow become integrated into the identity of the regime, that they're taking into account these other non-traditional security elements as well. But doesn't that mean then that they will never give up their nuclear weapons? It has become part of their identity. That's possibly an argument that there's no use in negotiating at all because they'll never give it up. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think that, first of all, negotiations is not only about giving up all the nuclear weapons they have. Negotiations is also about freezing the nuclear program and prevent proliferation from North Korea to other countries. There are multiple threats in play in this time. So it's not just about that. And the second point is that I don't think that North Korea is ready for a complete, irreversible, verifiable denuclearization right now. But I think that with time, if they can feel enough secure and if they can replace this part of their identity or ideology of the regime with something else, for example, prosperity, economic development, then they can present this to the domestic audience, not as a defeat, the fact that they're giving up nuclear weapons, but the fact that the country has grown, now it's secure, we don't need nuclear weapons because we are not in a hostile environment anymore, the country is growing. So I'm quite sure that is not a short-term process. And in the short term, the best thing will be to stop nuclear activities and just start from them. But in the long term, I think that it can also lead to complete denuclearization of North Korea.
Well, Dr. Milani, thank you so much again, not only for coming all the way to D.C., but talking with me here on the podcast.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everybody, again, for joining us. Please do remember to subscribe to Korean Context if you like our content. And we'll see you here again with another episode next week.